CliffCentral.com. Sanmunan Nonke, welcome to the show. Today I share the mic with a man who has cufflinks that are more expensive than my yearly salary. That's not saying much for his cufflinks, more
it's
the state of my salary. And his name is Colin Coleman, and he's the managing director of Goldman Sachs South Africa. Of course, we've been doing this series called Frankly Speaking, Is There a Way to Change Major South African Economic Challenges? We've been speaking to unions, we've been speaking to entrepreneurs, we've been speaking to education, and now it's the turn of big business. And who better to speak to than Colin Coleman? He's been an industry leader for a long, long time, someone who's done exceptionally well for himself, but also exceptionally well for the country in terms of leading the way in big business. You've done some amazing things, and we'll get to some of those initiatives as well. Colin, thank you for joining me today, and welcome to the show.
Absolute pleasure.
If you want to ask Colin some questions, we have on Facebook and Twitter been asking the whole weekend, and some interesting questions have come through. I'll get to some of those as well. Mm-hmm. But you can hit us up at yebo_levy, or you can hit WeChat, Cliff Central, and ask your questions to Colin Coleman. Colin, on the show, we always like to tell our listeners where we sit. We're very biased. It's not your normal radio interviews. We're very frank. I've got to say that I feel, coming into this show, a bit like a socialist on Donald Trump rant in the 80s. But really, my feeling is big business has let South Africa down in a way, and in many ways aided and abetted in the catastrophe that we call SA today. And I suppose that's where we start. And I want you to help me to potentially change my opinion on this. I'm not naive enough to think that, of course, we don't need big business and that big business hasn't played a huge role. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on where we are as a country today, where big business is leading the way and where it's failed. You know, let's be honest about that as well. So let's start with the state of South Africa. You're a huge, I would say, patriot. I've heard some of your interviews over the past while. You know, you've been an instrument not only in democratic South Africa, but fighting the apartheid government as well. Your whole family has. Tell me what you think the state of South Africa is right now.
Okay, well, let me just start off by saying, obviously, South Africa is in a suboptimal place, but your opening suggested that business has been wanting. Mm. I would say the reality is that all sectors, government, business, labor, civil society, all South Africans, mm-hmm. are part of this journey. And at times, different sectors have been stronger or weaker, mm. have behaved better or not so well. Mm. And we're all in it together. So, you know, the blame game doesn't really work. It's a question of how do we all rise from this point. I would say, when I say we're at a suboptimal point, clearly the last 10 years under President Zuma, you know, one can see, particularly in the last 5 years, an economic decline, which has infected the welfare of all South Africans, particularly the poor. There have been some areas in which we've outperformed and some areas where we've massively underperformed. Mm. And the underperformance areas are dominating at the moment. And obviously the issues around corruption, around Guptagate, around issues relating to state capture have become almost all-encompassing at this point because we're unable to move forward without defeating state capture, by which I mean so much of the South African economy is dependent on fair regulation or fair licensing or good economic policy, or state-owned enterprises, systemic like Eskom or Transnet, which provide, you know, monopoly providers of either electricity or transport services to the economy, without which the economy can't operate normally. So unless we fix these entities and then in turn fix the issues which are preventing proper policy, actually, business finds itself in almost an impossible position. And the people who suffer are the employed who become unemployed or the unemployed looking for work, which are, you know, 9 million people in South Africa, 16 million employed. This is extraordinary in numbers. And obviously, the racial skewing of the unemployed means that the majority of people experiencing these problems are African youth, and African people, particularly in the rural and the peri-urban areas, who have really no hope at this point. We have this sort of classic duality post-apartheid of a two-speed economy, one that's been doing quite well in the post-apartheid period, but has been suffering of late. And the second sort of duality has been those that have been marginalized and excluded right through this period, and we haven't really managed structurally in the economy to open the economy to those people. And those are the people who are young women, black South Africans, who really have no hope.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You speak about this a lot, the tale of two countries, you know, the peri-urban and the rising black middle class, 10 million strong. Things seem to be going on the up. Why haven't we created access for those peri-urban young black people with the resources that we have in this country?
I think right now, you know, the
and I mean, let me just also state that I'm not expecting you to have the perfect answer, just more your opinion. I mean, I think that's what the show is all about.
One of the secrets of my, or the lesser known parts of my CV, is that I actually studied architecture, and I bumped into Lindiwe Sisulu, who's the Minister of Housing, I was talking to her about this problem, and there's a very significant realization at the moment that the structural physical realities of apartheid have to be broken. In other words, people, you know, who in the Bantustans were put far away from economic opportunity, people growing up in large-scale semi-urban settlements like Winterveld, 1 million people outside Pretoria, people outside, if you go out Johannesburg, you go to Kasalinga, on the way you see where I used to go to school in the late 1970s, absolute barren land. Now, squatter settlements there, but people moving in closer to the cities. But the reality is there's no real opportunity, and there's no unification physically of the urban complexes. So we absolutely have to, in my view, in order to really deal with this question of this two-speed society, we're going to have to bring much more developmental projects that are going to have to be government-supported projects into the cities. And we're going to have to change the dynamics in the city and open up much more opportunity. It's actually quite an interesting opportunity in and of itself, because economically that will create a lot of activity. Mm. It will also start to unify the cities in a much more fundamental way. And if you look at, you know, I'm sort of borrowing on China. If you look at the Chinese experiments, obviously human rights issues were involved there. But they were very decisive in, you know, breaking down barriers in cities, but at the same time creating new cities, and created huge infrastructure projects associated with, you know, hundreds of new cities in China. We comparatively have done very little to nothing to change the apartheid spatial dynamic in South Africa.
Do you think that there's a reason for that in this way, that the rich have effectively checked out of South Africa, of all the systems? You know, we saw a huge model of Finland where they actually disallow any kind of private school education because they want the rich to be involved, so that they know that the rich and poor are getting the same kind of education. Of course, we know the rich has a powerful hand because of wealth, and that they can actually do something. So if they're out of the schooling system, if they're out of the healthcare system, if they're out, I mean, I'm just interested. I'm not saying that there's a choice. If you're rich, you want the best for your children, yourself, in terms of healthcare and education. But do you think that might be an issue, that they've actually created this two-state society because they've effectively gone, well, government's not providing, so we need to provide for ourselves?
When you say left the society, you mean left and gone overseas, or you mean left and created its own pockets of excellence?
Exactly.
Yeah, you mean the latter.
Africa,
because
exactly.
Let me just say, on the people that think that the rich have left South Africa, they have not.
No, no, no. I don't mean it by that.
I know. I'm just clarifying because you asked that question in a way that was ambiguous.
Okay.
But it's actually one of the greatest fables about South Africa. Do you know who's benefited the most in the post-apartheid dividend? Is the wealthy.
Mm.
The wealthy and white South Africans have created huge wealth and opportunity out of the post-apartheid period.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the sort of issues, I think, for black South Africans, is they've seen white South Africans do well, notwithstanding the BEE and empowerment issues. And there's been a subset of African, black South Africans who've done, you know, well. And those are the 10 million black middle class. And there's been a lot of people that, as I say, have been excluded. You know, this 9 million looking for work, unable to find it. Really, they are, you know, sort of the marginalized in society. But, you know, there have been pockets. So the dynamics we face in South Africa is one where there's a very big group that's been excluded. There's some people that have come in due to economic pressures, have been forced back out.
Mm-hmm.
And then there have been people in the society who actually do very well, live very well, have got wealthier. And so that's important. I would say for those inside the mainstream of South Africa, both black and white, the reality is that those people are using private sector education, health, and other services, refuse and other services, bypassing the municipalities, bypassing public school systems, bypassing education. I think it's a fallacy to blame people for that. I think the reality when you look at the statistics is that South Africa is spending huge amounts on public education and huge amounts of public health, well in line with other emerging markets, but the outputs are failing.
Because of tax, you're talking about being taxed?
So I'm just saying the amounts that the fiscus is investing in education and health, public education and health, is absolutely in line. We are not failing on the amount we're investing. We're failing on the output from that investment, the quality of the schools, the quality of the hospitals, the quality of the healthcare. And, you know, the statistics tell you that 80% of the education budget is salaried, either in administrative or public school teaching posts or other forms of administration. In the healthcare world, it's about 50%. So there's a significant amount of the budget that's being spent that's a very significant spending that comes down to people that we're employing. Are those people up to the job? Are they, you know, is performance management being administered properly in the public sector? Why are those teachers, the school principals, the administrators, the bureaucrats is not doing their job by the benchmark of outputs that we see on, you know, how much people are failing matric or the pass rate in maths and science, which is very poor. And we have to fix those structural problems. That's got to do with managing the society. You know, are the trade unions in those education and health departments facilitating proper performance or blocking proper performance? Is the government managing to weed out people who shouldn't be in the system and replacing it with highly capable people? You know, otherwise we're damning a generation because we're not getting the right teachers and the school principals and so on into place. And this is obviously controversial and difficult, but, you know, we shouldn't blame Netcare, Mediclinic, Life Healthcare for producing good hospitals at a price. You know, that's not the problem. The problem is when you go to the public hospitals in Hillbrow or Johannesburg or other places in the country, they're underperforming.
I'm interested, Colin, because I think you're a very smart man, probably one of the smartest men we've hosted on this show. I would love and imagine a scenario where you send your child to a public school. I'm assuming that you don't, but maybe that assumption isn't correct as well. So I must caution myself. But if your child was at a public school, you would be the one putting pressure on that principal to make sure that those standards are high and that your expectations of what your son or daughter is learning at school was absolutely high. So, you know, if you had an accident, you fell off your bike, or whatever the case may be, and you had to go to Johannesburg Gen, you would be the one going, "This is unacceptable," and you've got a lever in terms of power to change that. So it's not to say that the discoveries of this world and the Netcares of this world are doing bad things, but there's a conundrum there, isn't there? Where we're placed in a situation where we're saying we want the best for ourselves and our children, but at the same time, it's very quick to blame people when we don't have the skin in the game.
It's a fundamental point. I can only agree with what you're saying. And, you know, we all have people who are interfacing with the public and the public health, people that work for us, people that are in our families, doctors that we go to, whoever, who are in that public education and public health system. And we hear the stories. And there are heroic deeds to being done by many South Africans to do exactly what you're saying, which is improve those schools, manage those schools, do what they can. And some are doing well and some are not doing well.
Mm.
But this dynamic of the insiders who are, as you say, enjoying the fruits of our democracy in a very good way, even with many frustrations that they have daily, versus those who are completely outside the system, who are really reliant on social welfare. It produces a very interesting political dynamic, doesn't it? Because in a way, the rural and the poor and the marginalized who are in many instances, you know, getting the worst end of the public education and health system are reliant on the people because of social welfare who are putting that public education and health system in place in the first place.
Yeah.
And but the subsistence around social welfare, getting the child and old age grants and those issues which are reaching 17 million South Africans today and effectively make the difference between being able to pay for food on the table or not, these are the people who are going to vote you know, the ruling party back into power in the next election, to the extent that that happens. Whereas, you know, the people are well off who've benefited from many of these policies, you know, are almost free to determine where they're going to move in a political sense.
Why do you think that is? I feel like I've also been dumbfounded by this in the past. Why do you think that those people who are marginalized, who don't have the services, don't have the good education, don't have the good public health care, are the ones voting for, you know, someone like President Zuma? What are we missing there?
Look, I think there's a couple of aspects. There's economic vested interest, just straight, as I say, how do you put your food on the table? Are you going to vote against the party that brought in social welfare that is paying the only source of cash that you have to buy the food in the ShopRites? So, you know, that's a very harsh reality. There's also a cultural issue. The ANC has spoken to the liberation feelings of South Africans for a century. It has, you know, effectively liberated people to be able to vote, enfranchise people, put in place a government. It may not be performing an optimal sense, but you know the culture of the liberation movement still permeates very, very deep. And African society, after 300 years of colonialism, you know, 20 years of or two decades and a bit of freedom, it's a very short time to lose the memory of 300 years of suppression. So I think that the ANC has got a lot of goodwill in South Africa that permeates down into the African community who trust and have confidence in them. But that confidence and trust is being broken by acts of corruption. And when people see, you know, the sort of level of feeding on the trough and celebratory displays of wealth from ill-gotten gains, corruption at municipal level or in the state-owned enterprises and so on, and people who have had nothing now have cars and are throwing parties in the townships, and the people with nothing see this, it's right in their face.
Yeah.
You know, so these issues are really undermining that, you know, deep historical solidarity with the liberation movement, and is really starting to fray. So I think that what we're going to see in December is really a binary moment, you know, where either the ANC manages to unify behind a kind of anti-patronage network, whoever comes to power, or that patronage network deepens. Patronage is a very interesting concept. If I can just indulge you for a minute and say, there's a famous World Bank economist who described patronage and corruption as a systemic distribution of ill-gotten resources by a political elite to itself and sufficiently to a political constituency to keep it in power. And it's a very good description. Sort of, you know, we just take all the emotion away of the system of corruption that's happening, where you know, the ANC is becoming much more a place for those that have nothing, that unemployed, sort of very a marginalized group to be able to get power and economic resources to feed off, because there's nothing else for them. And this is where the business model of business, you asked about big business, has to prove itself, that a modern, constitutional, inclusive, economic growth story is preferable in the long term and will, from its inclusivity, feed a much broader group of South Africans than we managed to do in the last 23 years.
Okay, if you've just joined us, welcome to the show. We're speaking to partner and MD of the South African Goldman Sachs, Colin Coleman. Have I got that right, Colin?
Yeah, I'm the partner in charge of Sub-Saharan Africa. So awesome. For the last 10 years, we've been also trying to build a business outside of South Africa and Africa, and it's sort of necessary to also service our multinational clients and our South African clients properly.
Awesome. If you've just joined us, welcome to the show. We're asking, frankly speaking, is there a way to change South Africa's major challenges? South African challenges, of course, we've done a series on this, and you should definitely listen to some of the opinions that we've housed so far. Very, very, very interesting. Colin, we've been speaking about South Africa. Let's get into big business now, and let's talk about some recent events. I saw you on a show a few months ago. It was actually a month ago, before a lot of different big business scandals came out. And the interviewer asked you about credibility in the big business world. And you said, big business has credibility still. Do you still feel that view is valid, given the recent events of KPMG, McKinsey, and SAP?
So Business Leadership South Africa, which I'm on the board of, has around 80 members.
Mm-hmm.
We've been in the post-Nenegate environment, which was December 2015, extremely seized with the issues around South Africa, because many businesses woke up with Nenegate to the reality that actually the power dynamics in South Africa seemed to have shifted and deteriorated significantly, particularly asking the question, is there a shadow state in South Africa
right.
around President Zuma that is effectively, in a sort of anti-constitutional sense, taking decisions, which seems to be the underlying dynamic of the Gupta Gate saga, which is, where does power lie in South Africa? And is there a shadow state around President Zuma where the Guptas are central, determining who's in power, who's not? But I would just say that the 80 members of BLSA have been very much on their guard as to what is happening. And we have been very active around supporting the Constitution, about ending corruption. And we launched recently a contract with South Africa and an integrity pledge. And that integrity pledge basically pledged that our activities, all of business's activities in terms of what we did, had to be consistent with what we were saying externally to the external world. So when it emerged that KPMG and McKinsey had been allegedly involved in wide-scale issues which have been brought to the fore around conspiring in the KPMG case with SARS around trying to oust Pravin Gordhan, and in the McKinsey case, them looking to large contracts with Eskom,
$1.6 billion.
Hey? Yeah, huge. In association with the Trillion firm as an intermediary around Eskom and Transnet contracts, we acted very fast. McKinsey is not a member of BLSA,
yes, saw that.
But KPMG was, and we suspended. We acted to suspend KPMG's membership. And then last week, we acted to actually suspend Eskom and Transnet. Transnet had ceased to be a member, I think, in August, but Eskom had still remained a member. And we felt that this was entirely consistent with our integrity pledge that we needed to act. But it doesn't mean because three companies that are or have been members of BLSA now contaminates all the members of BLSA. Sure. It's not the case. And so we are very vigilant about how we're going to expect our members to behave. And all 77 that remain as members, we believe, are very active, very constructive citizens in South Africa. We're extremely active around trying to promote you know, all the issues surrounding job creation in South Africa, smaller micro enterprise development, all the issues that we're dealing with about youth employment, and I'm happy to talk about those issues.
I definitely will get to that and give you a chance to speak about that, because I think there's some very interesting things going on. But I want to hear from you from a personal perspective. I mean, Trevor Huell was part of that 81 initiative of CEOs, and you've obviously rubbed shoulders with him a few times in different circumstances. How did it feel when all this stuff started coming out in the papers, you heard it on the radio, about potentially KPMG, this big business leader, you know, and someone, a CEO that you might have respected in the past, who's been part of the CEO leadership initiative, signing the documents and being on that 81 list? How did it feel for you personally when you start seeing this stuff and hearing about how a guy on our team suddenly is actually playing for the other team?
Well, I must say, you know, KPMG I know less well, personally. So when you ask personally, I know McKinsey extremely well. And one of the senior partners is a family friend. And in regards to them, I must say I was shocked and disappointed about these activities. You know, McKinsey, like Goldman Sachs, is sort of the Rolls Royce of its industry.
Yeah.
You know, the consulting industry looks to McKinsey for the best-in-class behavior. And it appears that they've let themselves down. So I don't want to, you know, speak publicly in a damning way. I sort of hope that they will find a way to rectify this and manage it. And you have to, you know, you in our situation, you can't condemn and not allow for these global organizations to come to the party and make sure that they take remedial action. But we'll watch the space and see what they do.
Have you changed your actions in terms of how you are now focusing on these big multinationals and working with them specifically? Or is it a situation of saying, well, let them sort themselves out and we'll sort ourselves out?
Yeah, all we can do is apply our own standards internally. But I think we have been. You know, I can tell you for the last several years, we've been extremely vigilant as Goldman Sachs as to what we do, with whom we do it, in the context of a heightened state capture reality in South Africa. So as the partner of Goldman Sachs here, I've been extremely vigilant with my team in a way, probably very harsh with them, but it's to protect the firm and to protect our reputation, which is more important than anything. But we have our controls and we apply them very, very strictly, and we're very eyes open about what's going on here.
Must be difficult though, because I mean, if you think of the SOCs and SOEs, depending on how you call it, but they've got big money to spend. They are big money spenders, and Goldman Sachs has to make money at the end of the day. Their shareholders demand it, right? Must be difficult
There's no amount of money that we can make, whether it's $200 million on a contract with Eskom or wherever. That warrants denting our reputation. We just won't do it. So we're very, very focused on doing the right thing, living our principles, living our values, and making sure that before we act on any transaction, we have our processes, whether it's business selection, clearance, compliance, all sorts of issues that we go through. And if they don't pass those tests, it ain't going to happen.
Speaking to Sub-Saharan Africa MD, Mr. Colin Coleman, and he's also a partner at Goldman Sachs, about what big business should be doing. Got a few questions from our audience as well. We'll get to them before we end the show. I love throwing in a Batabile Dlamini quote every now and again. And Colin, I got to ask you, as a captain of industry, if we had to expose our small Inyana skeletons to the world in the closets that surround Santon in this office that we are in at the moment, do you think that you'd be surprised what's been going on?
Well, the Guptagate emails are, you know, revelation in and of themselves. It's not that we didn't know in general terms what was happening, but when you read the specifics, you know, day in and day out, it really takes your breath away. It takes my breath away. And I don't think we've heard everything.
Does that scare you?
Yeah, it feels
that
to me...
That your name might pop up, or Goldman Sachs' name might pop up?
No, I'm not concerned about my name or Goldman Sachs' name. I know exactly what we've done. There's no skeletons in that sense. What scares me is the degree to which this is systemic. You know, when Fanzel Slabbert, I remember talking to him many years ago, and he was sort of warning in a conversation I had with him about corruption and how corruption in Africa becomes part of the furniture, was what he mentioned. This part of the furniture, you know, where it's just so systemic that it's difficult to, like a cancer, you know, give chemotherapy treatment and get rid of it because it's everywhere. And so that's what I'm concerned about. You know, and when you call it, when you talk about Bataglini Dlamini, you know, the thing that sort of most I thought you're going to ask about is the real tragedy is South Africa is so full of talent. You know, if you look at the business community, you look at government, you look at the ANC people that came through the resistance movement, you look at civil society, even the trade union leaders that we deal with, these are outstanding people. And our ability as a society to produce outstanding people is not in doubt. But we've kept these outstanding people on the margins, consciously, it seems, in the last 10 years, in order to weaken the society and our leadership. So, you know, hopefully if we turn the corner in a positive way in the next year or two, you know, we'll see the good South Africans take their position as leaders in state-owned enterprises, in the cabinet, in business, in trade union movement. And that's the sort of precondition we require to get real movement forward.
I'm interested in the numbers now. You've been quoted as trying to do a lot of work with the finance and the treasury departments at the moment with Malusi Gigaba. How is that? Like, what's the relationships there in terms of what are you doing as a individual and as part of these CEO leadership initiatives and BLSA? How are you guys working with government at the moment to try and rectify?
Well, the CEO initiative is really the heart of our engagement with the finance minister and the president. It's run by Jabu Mabuza, who's also the chairman of BLSA and BUSA. What we're effectively doing is engaging on what we see as the critical issues of the day, in particular the systemic state-owned enterprises, not SAA, by the way, because
I was about to talk about $5.5 billion in 8 weeks is quite a bit of money to give to SAA.
Yeah, but SAA is small in reality relative to an Eskom or a Transnet. Eskom is an operating and systemic risk to South Africa. It's a, you know, the scale of the enterprise, you know, 350 billion rand of net debt of 37 billion rand of EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization.
I'm so glad you said that because you lost me and about 50% of
us. I'm trying to help your audience, but I
appreciate that.
You know, that is by any calculation 9.5 times. It's a very highly levered state-owned enterprise. That amount of debt can really infect the banking system if it goes bad. So we're very focused on fixing the things that are critical to South Africa, or at least advising.
And critical to you, right? Because as you just mentioned, if Eskom goes bad, then the banks are in trouble, right? Because it's so
more
heavily leveraged.
You know, Goldman Sachs is not a local bank with, you know, our risk to relative to South Africa is relatively small. But it's the large banks in South Africa and the life offices, all the institutional investors that have the most to lose, you know. So so that's critical for them. But it's really about South Africa and its fiscal stability as a nation. But SAA is small. You know, it's 16 billion rand of debt. By comparison with 350 billion, you know, it's not going to shake the system. We might lose a national airline and a logo on the side of a plane, but that's not going to shake the system. But we are trying to advise, help, assist, give our views in a constructive spirit to the finance ministry, to the president. You know, we have called there are two critical issues that we wait for the president to deal with still since our meeting at the end of April. The one is introducing an investigation into state capture as described and advised by the public prosecutor, which we've urged him to proceed with. It's getting late in the day, isn't it? And the second is the you know, the appointment of an independent, credible, experienced chairman of Eskom, and a new board of Eskom, and a credible management that is effectively cleansed of the corruption allegations of the past. And those are the two critical issues on which we remain engaged. Then there's things on which we are partnering with government, which include the youth employment service project called YES, to attempt to create 1 million internship opportunities over a 3-year period starting in January next year. And the small micro enterprise fund that Adrian Gore and Brian Joffe have launched with 1.5 billion rand of equity that's been raised throughout the business community for the purposes of facilitating smaller micro enterprises, both a funding and a mentoring mechanism, which we think is constructive. So there are things on which we try to be part of the solution, things on which really the government has to do, but we can advise and assist.
So let me, I do want to get to that stuff. I just want to park it for a second. Let's just talk quickly about business and when business oversteps its mark. I want to hear your opinion, because I've often been interested doing a bit of research on the Colemans. You see, I come prepared. It must be an interesting dinner table discussion when we have a trade unionist, a big businessman, and an anti-apartheid activist sitting at one table. And that really is the history of your family. You've been very involved in the anti-apartheid struggle back in the day. And now we sit at, you know, the leaders in all different aspects. I mean, what a family. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts on trade unions and the ANC and their connection and how close they are, and specifically, obviously, the Tripartite Alliance and COSATU. Do you think that that's a good thing, to have such close ties to government as the major unionist in the country, with government being the biggest employer of most of those union people? Do you think that's a good thing?
You know, the interesting thing, if you just take a helicopter step back and look at what happened, you know, in the post-94 period, the ANC, COSATU, and the South African Communist Party were really tied together in an operating way very closely. And then, you know, over time, under Mbeki, that became frayed and much more challenged. And there was the problems around gear, the RDP, and issues like that. And over time, you know, has become more point of conflict within the alliance. And in the current period, we now have a situation, actually, where the business community, the South African Communist Party, civil society, and the trade union movement are really speaking with one voice about state capture and supporting the constitutional state. And we may have differences over the model of economic growth, but we had a very interesting meeting with the Central Executive Committee of COSATU, which we made public for a weekend. It was sort of going back to the pre-CODESA days of getting, you know,
guys from opposite sides of the table.
People from opposite sides together, and spending time together and getting to know that we weren't so unlikable to each other. And we had a fantastic weekend with the COSATU Central Executive. It was in June that I was very involved in facilitating. And we had a very powerful business delegation with the COSATU people. And we came up with some very interesting ideas about things that we were, you know, on the opposite sides of, and things that we felt we could explore. For example, manufacturing. There was a detailed presentation from the Manufacturing Circle, which is the organized formation of manufacturers, on how do we create 1 million manufacturing jobs in South Africa, which is obviously something very, very interesting to the trade union movement. And, you know, export processing zones with tax benefits, lightening the load on smaller micro enterprises, labor regulation, all of these very tough issues are part of the package of how we drive 1 million new jobs. But with a prize so big, I think the trade union movement were actually prepared to be very constructive about thinking in that direction. So on this score, I'm actually very, very hopeful. I think the one thing that these events in South Africa of late have done is reconfigured the positioning between business and the trade union movement for the positive. We may be oppositional in a sense, in a certain sense, but on the other side, on the other side, we are partners. We're both partners in businesses where trade union movements are representing employees, you know, we the enemies they love to have. You know, we are the people who hold the businesses together, put capital in the businesses, manage the businesses, but we also need their input. So there's an interesting debate, which I am personally quite interested in having. I know some of my business colleagues are less interested in it, which is, should workers be represented on boards of companies, like in the German model, which is what happens there. So we need to be open-minded about this. I'm just quite constructive at the moment. If we make the correct political choices as a country, either in the ruling party or in the national election process, I think we can see a new era in South Africa of political leadership that is strong, working with business and trade unions that have a much more constructive relationship.
It's one of the suggestions that the Leadership Initiative is giving at the moment to privatize Eskom?
Listen, to be, I think, very clear, if somebody had to say to any bank today, can you try and list Eskom? It's not listable today. You can't list Eskom. It's got too much debt. You know, the board and governance issues are wrong. There are operating questions over the model. There's tariff and regulatory uncertainty. So let's just cut through it. The ideological question doesn't hold, in the sense there's nothing that can be done right now. We have to fix the model under which Eskom operates. You know, the possibility of introducing private capital in to Eskom is a constructive discussion point. But, you know, are we going to sell Eskom to someone? No, we don't buy it today. Are you going to list it? Well, it's not in a state to be listed. Is there a different model for operating Eskom? Well, I wouldn't say distribution is a constructive area for dialogue, but there are ways in which you can do smart things to re-equitize Eskom around transmission and generation assets.
So help me understand that, because I don't come from the high finance world, you know, but...
Well, I'm being specifically vague.
Yeah, I see
because, I'm not in a position to say more. But so, I think at this point...
So I don't want you to say more about the specific deal, but help me understand, because doesn't that then put big business at a little bit of at odds, because they have something to gain then by helping Malusi Gigaba sort out Eskom, right? They have, and I'm not talking about the debt issues in banks. I'm talking about if, for example, Colin Coleman does a really good deal with Malusi Gigaba, and then Malusi says, right, Colin Coleman and Goldman Sachs can actually support in fixing Eskom by invigorating some funds into it, don't you then make huge amounts of money?
No, but this is really academic at this point in time. Honestly, the finance ministry has to determine, and the government has to determine, A, do they have a problem at Eskom? B, what is the scale of the problem?
So they're still wondering if they have a problem.
C, do they have to fix it? How do they fix it? So they have a long road to travel. So I don't think you should be worrying about what I'm going to be doing in December. I'll be on holiday.
Can I worry at some stage?
Watching,
yeah.
Watching what's happening at the ANC conference and hoping that it goes well.
Okay, Colin, before we get on to some of the solutions, because we're running out of time here, it goes so quickly. We've been speaking to the Sub-Saharan Africa MD for Goldman Sachs, Colin Coleman. Before we get to the solutions, let's talk a little bit and let's openly be honest about this. Where has big business in your mind failed?
Look, I think business in the pre-democracy period partly came to the party in something called the consultative business movement and other things where we facilitated talks I was very much part of. But in the pre-1990 period, let's say mid-80s, you know, business was not very loud. The voice in the 85-87 period when I was on the student campus, you know, getting shot at by the police in those days, and the repression was at its height, you know, business was not, did not have a loud voice then at the darkest days.
Well, they were colluding with the apartheid government, right?
And there was benefits that people were benefiting. So I would say that was a period of failure. that was partly compensated by the engagement of some of the business people in the post 89 period leading up to the 94 90, but that's a subject of a book I'll write one day.
I was gonna say, that's a history lesson. Let's get into now contemporary.
And I think in the post 94 period, I think business was a little bit complacent, I would say, for a period, particularly in the Mbeki and the beginning of the Zuma years. There was complacency because things were going reasonably well. There was sort of 3.2% growth rate through the period, even 5%. There was probably not enough support for President Mbeki from the business community, and he had his quirks. You know, the Zimbabwe and the AIDS issues, you know, were real blind spots that he had. And I regard him extremely highly, but I would tell him that I think he failed in those regards. But it created an environment, and, you know, his aloofness in many senses was difficult for business to deal with. But at the same time, he was engaged with the business community through his International Advisory Council and various things. And there was a period in which there was some engagement. But business wasn't using that period enough to deal with this inclusive growth issue. You know, are we satisfied that there's enough jobs being created, enough investment, that we look thinking out of the box in fixing the social issues in South Africa? So the things like the Youth Employment Service project we're doing now, if you'd done them then, we would be far more advanced. But I think in the Nenegate, as I say, Nenegate was that moment where business woke up and said, look, there's things amiss here. We have to get stuck in and try and resolve these problems.
Where have you failed as a business leader? Where do you think that you failed in the South African context? And I say that very humbly because I know you've done a lot for South Africa. So it's you know, if you feel like you haven't failed, that's okay. But where have you personally failed? Looking back at the history that you've come through and the incredible stuff that you've done, is there a moment where you're like, yeah, I probably could have done more there, or geez, that was my blind spot? You know, right, we speak about Mbeki's blind spots.
Right.
Where do you think your blind spots were?
Well, actually, you know, speaking in support of the Mbeki period, I think I could have done more at that time to encourage business people to support him. You know, as be a voice out there saying what he's doing is very constructive, because he was really promoting economic growth and taking a lot of hits with the trade union movement and the alliance, and business was very quiet. So I think I personally could have been much more out there. Obviously, around the global financial crisis, I felt somewhat exposed, in the sense that in the 2008 period, 2009, you know, I felt the million jobs that were lost. I'm talking about in South Africa, as opposed to the global situation. You know, was a huge sacrifice that South Africa was forced to make at that time. And I thought about various ways in which I could make representations. I don't know if you remember, Jacques-Marie, you know, effectively said he would give up some of his salary and compensation towards societal benefits. So while I do participate in philanthropy through something called Goldman Sachs Gives, which is something reserved for the partners, it's a sort of an account where we have a fund that's part of our compensation that goes to that, and we make investment in philanthropy. I'm not saying it was a failing, but I did wonder if there was a more constructive way for me to behave at that particular point in time. And we just sort of shouldered the wheel now. You know, I'm on the CEO initiative. I'm on the BLSA board. I'm on the NBI board. I'm running this Youth Employment Service initiative with Stephen Kossoff, as my partner, sort of spearheading that in the business community and trying to manage Goldman Sachs' business in sub-Saharan Africa. So we're very busy doing what we can and very engaged with issues in the broader society.
So a comment from our Facebook viewers, from Bradley Shaw, he says he wants to know, is Colin Coleman personally disinvesting from South Africa? Have you stopped all your investments in terms of South Africa? I'm sure you have a number of different portfolio activities going on. Are you concerned? Have you stopped putting investment into South Africa personally, or are you still feeling like it's business as usual? I know it's quite a personal question, so yeah. Bradley asked it. I got to ask it on his behalf. But well,
thanks, Brad. And you know, people do ask me from time to time how, because they want to know what am I doing and how do I feel about what's going on. And the subtext of this question is what are the options into the future, because people are unsettled by what is going on, and there are many people asking themselves, you know, do I have a place in South Africa? Is South Africa a place where I should be investing? And that's an unfortunate reality brought about by the situation. And personally, I have, you know, all my physical assets in South Africa. I don't own homes anywhere else. I have three homes in South Africa, and one of them I've renovated and bought in the last 2 years, and it's been a bit of a pet project going back to my architecture days to renovate. But I understand the question, and I think the question probably comes from a good place. The place is, what's responsible for people to be doing? I think there's a lot of people waiting for December to see how this works out, because the ruling party's decision really is instrumental in where South Africa goes. You know, if we choose a patronage path, the next 10 years is going to be a long-term economic decline. And if we choose a path in favor of constitutionalism and democracy, you know, there is a very good chance that we're going to get back to 3 to 5% growth rates in the next 2 to 5 years. On the other hand, if the patronage choice is made, it's going to produce very interesting national politics between the ANC and others. I would suggest that it's likely there will be a breakaway from the ANC if that choice is made. In the post-December period, and then you'll have a competitive political situation that may mean that coalition politics is what emerges sooner than we think. I don't think that Nkosazana Zuma, if she was to be victorious, will be able to hold off having a national election until 2019. I think it'll happen earlier. I think they'll dissolve parliament and bring an election earlier. And then we'll have a very robust national election, and we'll see where it comes out.
This sounds like insider trading. Hey? We've heard some very, very interesting conversations here. Colin, 1.1 trillion big businesses holding back, supposedly. That's a big number. What's the story there?
We just did, which I hope you'll go to the Business Leadership South Africa site, which is on Facebook and various other things. We just did a study, actually, which disproves the notion that South Africa's business is hoarding cash. I would say that there's an opportunity to invest more cash balances of businesses in South African projects. But be realistic. You know, when your Minister of Mines is attacking the South African mining community, and they're at odds with the Chamber of Mines, are the mines going to be making large-scale cash investments in this time? No. They're going to wait until there's more policy clarity and clarity as to where empowerment and other issues are going. But in general terms, the proportion of cash balances to GDP is not out of line with the international community. South Africa's businesses are highly resilient, very well managed, and they are looking for the optimal capital returns. And those capital returns historically have come in South Africa and have done extremely well in South Africa, even on a dollar translated basis.
Mm-hmm.
So with the right environment, I think we'll see that capital invested. But to the extent we are on a road which is anti-business, you won't see the capital invested. To the extent that there's an environment supporting business, you will.
Is that a lever that big business has?
It's not an. I don't mean it as an ultimatum, but I think
because it could come off as a bit of a threat, right? I mean, if you think about Melusi Gigaba wants to, and the finance department wants to collect 1.3 trillion rand in taxes this year, that's down actually from what they got last year. But that's you know, if we talk to the numbers that the media is spewing out there, that's equivalent to what big business holds right now and saying, well, we're going to just hold that as cash reserves. Is that a little bit of a threat to say, hey, man, get your house in order, otherwise we're not going to be around?
It's just, I think the economic, it's not that we're not going to be around. It's just, you know, are we going to be investing, you know, are mining companies, logistics companies, pharmaceuticals, telecommunications companies, are they going to go the extra mile to invest capital when they're uncertain about the returns or the value of the rand or their returns on equity? No, they naturally at the board levels will be concerned and be prudent in the interest of shareholders. They will be. But to the extent that there's a virtuous cycle of good policy, good economic outlook, some certainty. I'm not saying just a free market environment. What we want is we want an effective state.
Mm.
We don't really mind an interventionist state. You know, this is the ideological blind spot. You know, people say business needs a free market. We need a functioning market. We need an effective state. We don't want money wasted or stolen. We don't want an anti-business environment in the sense of policies that are designed to punish business. So if you have a virtuous cycle, you know, you'll get more investment, you'll get more capital flowing, you'll get more opportunities, more jobs, more infrastructure, more benefits to a wider group of people. That's what we want.
Just let's talk a little bit about what business is doing. The Yes campaign has been a topic of interest for me personally. I've been watching it. I saw you speak at one of the conferences about the Yes campaign and how it was put on pause. 330,000 jobs a year, that's what you're looking to create through this campaign. Paused after the Pravin Gordhan incident. Now seems to be back on target. Talk me through, how are you going to do this? How are 330,000 jobs going to be created a year overnight? Give me a sense of what you're planning there.
What we're creating is work opportunities, not permanent jobs.
Okay.
The work opportunities are one-year internships in companies, paid. So people should expect that, you know, they'll get the minimum wage or more payment for that opportunity. There'll be onboarding of people through a training process, and there will be exit processes so that the work interns will get an accreditation that they'll be able to use on a CV going forward, that they've participated. And the literature basically suggests that if you've had the opportunity to work in a business, your probability of getting permanent employment, even if not with that particular business, is much higher than if you don't do that.
Mm.
So it is a pathway. We will have a registration process where businesses will register as Yes companies, and they will set their targets that they will be required, and we're going to reveal more about it when we publicly launch this, which will be soon. And there will be an incentive package for businesses to participate, again, the details of which will become known. But we've been negotiating this, and we expect that the cabinet will discuss this further in the course of October, and that we'll be able before the end of the year to make announcements, detailed announcements, and how it will work for your benefit.
And in terms of partnering on the ground, because as you said, you're a busy man dealing with just Goldman Sachs and business leadership and all these other things.
So this is really all of the CEO initiative companies and business leadership South Africa, all the big companies, but not only them, the medium-sized enterprises and small and micro enterprises will be able to join Yes and participate as Yes companies and get the benefits of being a Yes company, which will be, I think, very strong incentives to doing that. We can't reach our 330,000 a year, which will be ramped up over time, without small and medium enterprises participating, because out of the 11.5 million non-domestic employees in South Africa, only about 2 million are in the large companies, the sort of top 100 companies. The balance is in the medium and smaller companies. So it's very important that those companies participate to reach our targets.
Okay, last question, and we're going to have to wrap it up there. And if you can make it brief, that'd be great. Yep. The 2 decades of freedom, a 20-year report. Chiefs, you must hate when interviewers bring that up all the time. In 2013, you released this report.
I love that report.
Yeah. It's a report that reads like the 2010 World Cup of reports, really. I mean, it shows like South Africa that is idealized, looking back at it now and going... What we wrote in there, what the figures that we pulled, any regrets that you have,
and any things that you think
are different now?
There's no regrets at all. Those facts were the facts. It was a very factual based report, and what we showed was the strengths of the post democracy period: the black middle class, social welfare, the support for the poor, the challenges we showed very clearly were the unemployment and structural. Issues surrounding inequality in South Africa, and we put out the challenges, which was all of the structural reforms that we've been talking about. So nothing has changed. The thing that's changed with over the last 4 years since that report was released is obviously the economy has gone into a negative trajectory. We're underperforming the growth rate, so we're more like 1.5-2% growth rates than the pre-report publishing 3.2% growth rate. So the structural reforms have not been, the recommendations have not been adopted effectively, which is extremely disappointing.
Mm.
You know, I presented that report to President Zuma and the top six of the ANC in October 2013. And I would think that if we'd followed those structural reforms that we'd recommended in the report, we'd be in a much better position.
Junk status in pre-democracy, back to junk status again. It's going to be an uphill battle from now, Colin. Thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it, man. Thank you. And I look forward to having one or two more conversations with you, hopefully in the future, when we see what the Yes campaign gets up to. And also when we see what big business does in terms of past December. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, please do hit us up on Twitter. And if you missed any of this podcast, cliffcentral.com/frankly speaking. And we'll see you again next week. Thanks so much. Ciao, ciao. Cliffcentral.com.